supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Mosco, and welcome to The Connection. Our guest, psychologist Sunita Saw, writes in her new book that from a young age, we are taught to obey. She was an obedient child herself. She got excellent grades, was taught to be quiet and good by her parents, which by her account, she was. She was also the daughter of Indian immigrants living in England, where they were not always welcomed. She saw the taunts and jeers and wanted to blend in. Fast forward to today, Sunita Saw has become an authority on defiance, compliance, and consent. That's what she writes about in her new book, Defy, The Power of No in a World That Demands Yes. Now, we can all feel the pressure to say yes when we mean no, to keep our mouths shut when we see something that's wrong, to muzzle our opinion to avoid conflict. Saw says that can be bad for our mental and physical health and for the larger society. She wants to redefine what defy means with a new definition, to act in accordance with your true values when there is pressure to do otherwise. Today in The Connection, how to speak up when it matters. Sunita Saw is a physician-trained organizational psychologist at Cornell University, joining us on The Connection. And Sunita Saw, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, I'm going to start with you and just a little bit about your childhood. You describe your childhood as a masterclass in compliance. Your name in Sanskrit actually means good. Was it a heavy burden to be that good girl growing up? Were you jealous of the troublemakers that you saw in your world?
So I was good. I thought that was the way to be. It was the way that I was taught to be, which was, you know, do what you are told, go to school on time, do your homework. And I was fascinated by people that found it easier to defy than me. So that did fascinate me. And when I got to high school, one of my closest friends was somebody who was far more defiant than me. And I think that was part of the attraction.
Well, I was wondering, you know, how does this good girl then, who wanted to please everybody, become an expert in defiance? I mean, is that a sort of act of defiance on your own part?
I think my career path has been an act of defiance to a certain extent. So as you said, my first career was in medicine. I had the grades and I was told medicine is the best thing you can do. So even though I had some reservations, I did go to medical school and I finished medical school and I worked as a doctor. But leaving medicine, people say medicine is very hard to get into. I've been talking to a few people now and we say that medicine is actually quite hard to get out of at times. So the finding the career that I really wanted to do, which was research and becoming a professor, has been deeply rewarding. So in that way, I would say that that is an expression of defiance.
Well, as you say in this book, that most of us, you know, want to be good, to obey. But why do we go along with things that we don't agree with or we don't want to do? What is that kind of compliance about?
Well, there's multiple reasons why we comply and why we might actively resist defiance in other people. So one is this enormous pressure to go along with other people, sort of social pressure that we feel. And it's incredibly difficult for most people to defy an order, even if it's an unspoken one, whether it's from an authority, a peer, and what I found even in my research, even a stranger, it's really hard to sort of defy that social pressure that we have to go along with others. The second one is that we don't really understand what compliance and defiance are. And the third reason is once we decide to defy, we might not know how. We don't have the skill set, especially if we were socialized to be so compliant. We received lots of training in how to obey and how to be compliant, but hardly any training in how to be defiant.
Well, you quote this famous or maybe even infamous study, the Milgram study, where People were told to shock other people and shock them really, really violently, and to see how far people would go. Now, as it turns out, the people they were shocking were actors, so they were acting as if they were being shocked or not. But people did it. I mean, they were, in a sense, following orders. Someone told them to do this. How much do you think that is driving why we say yes when we want to say no?
I think that's a great example. The Milgram experiments that were conducted in the early 1960s are kind of infamous now. And really, they were set up to see whether this claim from the Nazis after World War II that we were just following orders was really a psychological reality. And what Milgram found was that so many people obeyed. And this went against what most psychiatrists were predicting. They were predicting that most people wouldn't continue after 150 volts and only about one in a thousand would go up to the very highest volt shock of 450 volts, which was labeled XXX, dangerous, extreme danger. But what they found was that every single participant pulled the lever for 150 volts and 300 volts, and 65% went up to the deadly 450 volts.
Wow.
What's fascinating about these studies that I found fascinating, there was many things, but Milgram called the participants who obeyed and went up to the dangerous shocks, the obedient ones, and the ones that refused, defiant subjects. So now we start to see why defiance can be a good thing.
Because you're being asked to do something, one, that goes against your values, but you're also being asked to hurt people. I mean, deliberately to hurt people. And you have kind of redefined defiance, or you want us to redefine defiance, and I'll repeat that, to act in accordance with your true values when there is pressure to do otherwise. Taking it out of the sort of disobedience category, right?
Exactly.
But you have to know what your values are, don't you, to know whether how you're going to act or not act?
Absolutely. So that's the step one that you do way before you're in any moment of crisis, is to really understand what your values are. And when I talk about the defiance compass, which I think is a very useful tool, the very first question is, who am I?
Right.
What, which really means, right, identifying your values. And that value exercise is very useful, because when you look at the people that could defy in the Milgram experiment, some of them were really connected to their values. And so they knew how to connect to their values, take responsibility, and also they knew how to defy. So connecting with your values is essential. When I teach my executive students, my MBA students, I always have them do a value exercise. So write out and explain why your values are so important. And I do that because the research shows that your intended behavior is more likely to follow your values if you're very clear about them and you've written them out and you've stated why it's important to you. Because what I've learned is that for many of us, the distance between who we think we are and how we actually behave is actually great. There's an enormous gap. And so writing out and being very clear about your values and being able to connect to them is deeply important.
I'm thinking about, I mean, we think of values as a good thing, and there are obviously good values: honesty, loyalty, fairness, generosity, empathy, respect, and there's a long list. But there are also, you know, negative values. There's lying, and there's greed, and there's cheating, and there's prejudice. I mean, how do we, you could say, well, know your values, and you could say, well, you know, I'm okay with lying. I mean, that would be an okay value in someone's life. How do we understand that?
Yeah, so I have not seen that, I have to say, from my students, but maybe they are self-editing when they're writing down their values.
Right.
Who knows?
Get a good grade.
Most of the time, and maybe I'm being optimistic here, but most of the time I think people have an ideal self of them as being a moral person. And so really what I think the bigger problem is not being able to reach our aspirational selves. So the types of values that I see over and over again, integrity is at the top. Mm-hmm. It is really highly valued in our culture. Like, nobody actually wants to be known as being dishonest or a liar. They don't like to label themselves as such. They like to believe that they have integrity and that they're honest people. Compassion, empathy, equality, they're the types of values that I see my students writing year after year. That's and they are quite deep in how they came to those values, usually some aspect of childhood or growing up that really taught them how to connect to those values.
But as you say, they're the things that we say about ourselves, who we think we are. And then there's what we do in this life and with those values, and they don't always line up.
That's right. There's a big gap between sort of intention and actual behavior. And that's why often we can sit back in an armchair and observe how others have reacted to a particular situation and say, well, we would never do that. We would. And there's actually a great study by Woodzicka and LaFrance that asked a group of young women who to imagine that they were applying for a job with a professor as a research assistant, and the professor started asking inappropriate questions. So the male professor would ask something like, do you have a boyfriend? Do people find you desirable? Do you think it's important for women to wear bras at work? Things like this that were pretty offensive. Right. And what the women reported is that they would be really angry if they received those questions and they would walk out of the interview. But when they actually conducted this experiment on women of a similar demographic from the same population, what happened is that nobody walked out. And the emotion that they felt wasn't anger, but it was fear. And some of them even smiled uncomfortably. I'm very familiar with that smile. I talk about my crocodile smile a few times, which is this instinctive small smile every time I feel pressure to do something or respond to something that I don't think is quite right. And so we have these values that if somebody said something in a meeting that was inappropriate or it was going to be harmful to someone, that we would speak up. But a lot of times we don't live up to those values, and we need to have some kind of plan as to how we can address those situations.
We have about a minute before our first break here, but you say that the defiance it's not a personality. It's something you can practice, that by maybe even running scenarios through your head, you can say, well, what would I do under this circumstance? You know, a person like me, how would they behave? That it's enough to sort of play act what you might do to get yourself to actually do it in reality.
Yeah, I think the practice aspect of defiance is really important, because a lot of us think that defiance is a personality. You need to have a big personality or be really brave or extraordinary. And that's not true. We can all learn it. It's a skill set. We can choose to utilize it or not.
And the idea of just sort of play acting, is that enough to sort of get us over the hump of reluctance, resistance?
So one of the things about practicing, and we can delve in a little bit more after the break too,
sure,
is that it requires like you to anticipate what events might come up. And most of the time we can predict the situations in which we need to defy because we've complied in the past, right? Even if you think about some of the famous what you might feel as defiant people in the past, like Rosa Parks,
sure,
who said no from moving on the bus. How many times had she complied before? Right? So we need to remember that we can probably anticipate the situations where we need to be defiant. Then we can visualize it, and then we can start practicing role-playing, scripting. That all changes the neural pathways.
And that is our guest, Sunita Sah. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking about why it's not easy to say no, to voice your opinion if you disagree with someone, or object to something that someone has said or done because you believe it is wrong. And again, our guest is Sunita Sah. She's a physician-trained organizational psychologist at Cornell University, and we're talking about her brand new book. It's titled Defy: The Power of No in a World That Demands Yes. Right before the break, you were talking about Rosa Parks, and there are others who have, you know, stood up. But as you say, there were probably many times she went to the back of the bus because, for whatever reason, the time wasn't right. And it does raise a question about sort of picking and choosing our battles, you know to go to the ramparts and when to hold back.
Yeah, so when is the right time and place to defy? So I mentioned earlier that the first question in the defiance compass is, who am I? So connecting with the values. The second question is, what type of situation is this? Right. And it's here where you want to assess the environment. Is it safe and is it effective for me to defy? Will it have a positive impact? And that's an important aspect of it, is assessing the environment, because sometimes it's not safe to defy, or we want to wait until it's safer and more effective. And then the last question, which you mentioned, was what does a person like me do in a situation like this, which is that aspect of connecting with your responsibility, your aspirational self, and living up to your values.
I was thinking about being passive aggressive, frankly. I'm talking about, rather than sort of confronting someone or defying them, you sort of sneak around. it's kind of cowardly in a way, in the context of our conversation, which is to be indirect rather than direct. Is there a place for passive aggressiveness in your worldview?
Well, when we talk about people being passive aggressive, it really is about sometimes emotions coming out in a way that's not direct, right? So it's often based on emotion. And when I talk about defiance, I talk about it as a decision rather than emotionally based. So if, again, I'm using Rosa Parks as an example here. Sure. Yes, there was emotion involved in her decision to defy, but it wasn't emotional. And so that is a big difference. But I do talk about a concept I call quiet defiance that I've identified. And that is actually a helpful tool to use in situations where it really is very costly to defy. So I've interviewed people in the military, in the army, and there are severe consequences for not obeying in those situations, and sometimes for good reason, right? Compliance is really helpful if you're on the battlefield.
Sure.
But we're often in situations where it's very difficult to comply. So this aspect of quiet defiance, which is actually engaging in defiance, but not publicly. It doesn't use the word no, and it could be done in private. So for example, in the Milgram experiments, when the experimenter who was asking participants to give electric shocks to another person, when they left the room and they gave the instructions via telephone, what we saw was that obedience went down a huge amount, from about 65% to I think about 20%. It went down a lot. And what interesting is that they often didn't tell the experimenter that they were not giving the larger shocks. They just said, yes, they're moving up in the shocks, but they were actually just giving the least shock of 15 volts.
Fascinating. Well, let's talk about a very public act of defiance at a prayer service at Washington's National Cathedral on Tuesday this week. Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy spoke directly to President Trump, asking his administration to show compassion for undocumented immigrants, for LGBTQ people, and other communities. Here's a portion of what she said.
In the name of our God, I ask you to have mercy upon the people in our country, who are scared now. There are gay, lesbian, and transgender children in Democratic, Republican, and independent families, some who fear for their lives. The people who pick our crops and clean our office buildings, who labor in poultry farms and meatpacking plants, they may not be citizens or have the proper documentation, but the vast majority of immigrants are not criminals.
She meets your definition of defiance, and to act in accordance with your true values when there is pressure to do otherwise. I mean, she was feet away from the president of the United States, who looked extremely unhappy. And as we know how he has talked about it afterwards, he has really gone after her. But she and what I read about her is that she thought very carefully about doing this. This was not something that she just thought of on the fly. She planned it out.
Yeah, so she is a real exemplar for the principles of defy and how I define defiance. And it's also a fantastic example to us. Like, how do we behave in these types of situations when policies threaten the most vulnerable in society, when we feel our voices are being silenced, when we actually feel, some of us, that resistance is futile? There was a recent New York Times article earlier this week as well, which was, the headline was, "Defiance is out, deference is in." And when we're seeing all this deference, Buddy's words were not just an act of courage, they're a roadmap and an example for how the rest of us can respond when our values are tested. And just standing before the new president, one of the most powerful men in the world, and giving that courageous plea was indeed something that we could all learn from in terms of defiance. So it was really amazing to see.
Indeed, and very powerful. And it does raise, I think you don't call it the bystander effect, but that, when people do defy, when people do stand up, speak truth to power, it does impact the rest of us. I mean, maybe gives us some little piece of courage that we might want to use.
Yes, absolutely. So, yes, I call this the defiance domino effect, in that defiance actually does change us. When we defy and we can live with our values, it actually makes us more ourselves, but it's transformative in that we can actually be ourselves rather than muting ourselves. But it also affects the people that observe it. It gives us hope, it gives us inspiration. And sometimes it only takes one person to start a great reaction, it make a great difference. And the other thing about her defiance that day is that she really emulated how defiance doesn't need to be loud or violent or aggressive. Like, we have this myth of it being like fiery and sort of angry, and it doesn't need to be that. It can be quiet, and you don't have to be larger than life or have a strong personality. You can defy in your own unique way. It's actually a skill that's available, and it's necessary for all of us to learn.
Let me quickly reintroduce you, and that's Sunita Sa. She's an organizational psychologist at Cornell University, and she's got a brand new book. It's titled Defy: The Power of No in a World That Demands Yes. Let me pick up on something, and I mentioned sort of good values, bad values, but I am sure that some people who attacked the Capitol on January 20th, 4 years ago, believed that they were saving our democracy. I mean, they obviously got their information from the wrong place, but nonetheless, that they believed in their hearts that what they were doing as an act of defiance was for the good of the nation. How do you see that? How should we see that?
I think some people would see that they were connecting with their values, and they believed there was a threat to those values, and they were acting in alignment with them. However, some people have said quite clearly that they regret their actions for that day. They're not really sure why they did that. And one particular person, Clayton Mullins, he is known for not being a violent man. He actually said and stated that he thought the election had been a fair one. And so, how did he get caught up in the crowd? How did he become violent and act in a way that went against his beliefs? Now, sometimes if we act with a crowd or we're pushed along, there could be a number of reasons that we're just conforming to the crowd, it's herd behavior, or that we're following the actions of a leader. If that is the case, then that's not defiance. It's what I call false defiance, because it's dependent on someone else. If defiance comes from within and acting on your true values, but you're swept along by the crowd, then it could look like defiance to other people, but and it has like all the costs of defiance, but it really is a shame, because if you are following somebody else's wishes and expectations, then that falls into the category of false defiance.
Let me quote Viktor Frankl, who you quote in the book, and I just love what he says here. And he's He was an Austrian, I should say, psychiatrist. He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And in it, and this is the quote in your book, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom, which again sort of gets to this, that tough decision often where who are we going to be? What are we going to do when faced with these, you know, two choices? In your case, it's sort of yes and no. You're asking us to make that decision that fits with our values. What do you read into what Viktor Frankl is telling us?
I think that's a very powerful quote.
Me too.
And I recommend what I call the power of the pause. So when we're in that situation, is to take a pause and ask ourselves these questions. Who am I? What type of situation is this? What does a person like me do in a situation like this? And if Clayton Mullins had asked himself that question, maybe the values that he'd previously stated of thinking the election was fair and being nonviolent would have come to the front. And he would have realized, I'm not that type of person to become aggressive and violent. And if we go back to sort of Bishop Buddy's example again, she emulates those values. She connected with her values for humanity, and she was able to enact them. So she took responsibility, and as we said, she took the time to prepare before coming and saying those things. It didn't happen spontaneously. It required that preparation.
And there was a gentleness and warmth in her voice. I mean, that, you know, that in as opposed to yelling and screaming about, you know, some righting some wrong.
Exactly. She wasn't shouting. She wasn't railing against authority. It was a courageous plea.
You talk about the stages of defiance. So beginning, how do we know if something we're doing something that doesn't fit our value system? What is the feeling? How does that feel to us so that we know, I'm betraying myself?
As well, so many people that I have interviewed, and I also feel myself, when we're in that type of situation where we're between two forces, between what we think is the right thing to do and what's expected of us, we tend to feel some tension. And that tension is actually the first stage of defiance. It's a warning signal that we might need to defy. If we look at the Milgram participants, even though the ones that he classified as obedient that went all the way to the end, many of them showed signs of tension. So there was nervous laughter, some swearing, muttering, asking questions. And these are different stages of defiance. And it was showing that they were following orders, but they didn't seem comfortable with it.
Hmm.
So often we feel that tension, and that is the first stage. And it might manifest in different ways for every person. It's likely to. Some people might feel uneasy in their stomach. Some people might feel their voice feeling restricted or a dry mouth. So we should get to identify what is the sign within my body that this makes me feel uncomfortable. The second stage is to really acknowledge that to ourselves, because often we just throw
away
our doubt.
Push
it away, and we think it's not worth thinking about. The other person probably knows better. And in doing so, we ignore a really powerful warning sign that our body is trying to give us.
And then we begin to sort of speak up both, I guess, to ourselves and then out into the world.
Exactly. So stage two is acknowledging to ourselves that something's not quite right here and really registering that. And then stage three, which is the critical one, is vocalizing that to someone else.
Right.
And that you can still be in a subservient position. So it's just asking very simple questions like, you know, what do you mean by that? Or can you clarify this for me? Or have you considered this? Or I'm just uncomfortable with that. I need to think about that. I'm uncomfortable with it. And that stage three is really critical, because once we vocalize that to somebody else, then the research shows that you're far more likely to get to stage five, the act of defiance, because you've already said that you're not comfortable. There's something you're questioning. You can't later go back with cognitive dissonance if you obey and say, I actually thought it was fine. So it really is just that question to begin with, that you're not sure.
Yeah. And you say the result of acting on your values, of being defiant, is authenticity. That is what we feel, that is what we get, in a sense, in return, which is that we are being our authentic self.
Right. So that tension that we have in stage one, that people want to try and push away, what's really fascinating is if you get to stage five and that act of defiance, all that tension seems to dissipate and we actually feel freer, that we have behaved in alignment with our values. And it is more joyful. It is more, it's a proud moment, and we're living a more honest life that has great rewards.
Well, and this is related to consent. As you say, consent is also rooted in our values. Informed consent, which we associate with doctors and going to the hospital, but that's, in a sense, what you're telling us to think about consent in our own world, which is that we are informed and then making a decision of yes.
Yes, absolutely. So when we think about compliance and consent, they're often conflated, but they're actually fundamentally different. So compliance is simply going along with something, and it's usually imposed by something external, somebody else asking you something, expectations from a boss, maybe from society. So that's compliance, it's just going along with it. Consent is fundamentally different. And I take informed consent in medicine and apply it to other decisions that we make in our lives. And we can all do this. And for informed consent, we need five elements. So first of all is capacity. We need the mental capacity to make the decision, that we're not under illness, drugs, alcohol. We have the capacity. The second element is knowledge. We need the information to make an informed decision. The third one is understanding. So we might have the information, but we need to thoroughly understand it, the risks, the benefits, and the alternatives. And then the fourth one is that we need the freedom to say no. Because if we don't have the freedom to say no, you can't have any consent. You can have compliance, but no consent. If those four elements are there, the capacity, knowledge, understanding, freedom to say no, then the fifth element is your authorization. If you want to go ahead with all those elements present, then you can give your informed consent. If you want to not go ahead, then it's your informed refusal or your true no or defiance.
We have to take another short break. And I love that that yes means more when we can say no. I'm just sort of underscoring that. Before we take that short break, and again, talking with Dr. Sunita Sah. She's an organizational psychologist, and she's got a new book we've been talking about. It's titled Defy, and it's subtitled The Power of No in a World That Demands Yes. And I think we all can relate to the pressure to say yes when we really mean no. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about the fact that it's not easy to say no. It's not easy to voice your opinion if you disagree with other people or object to something that someone has said or done because you believe it is wrong. It's often easier to comply, to go along, to get along, to defer, especially when we're dealing with people in power. In her new book, Sunita Sah has redefined defiance. She says it's not about rudeness or disobedience. Rather, it's, quote, about acting in accordance with your values when faced with the pressure to do otherwise. Well, let me get back to this whole notion of consent, because I find it really, really fascinating. But I'm also interested in the fact that oftentimes people in power feel as if they can throw their weight around, that's why they're in power, and get away with stuff that us mere mortals cannot do. But I wonder, the risk, the price of defying someone in power, the price of that, and how we should think about that and perhaps think about some of those risks and some of the prices involved in that.
Absolutely. So there are costs for defiance, right? So some of these costs, you know, it's what really makes us silent at times. Yeah. These are the things that keep us compliant at times, is fear of the consequences. So we fear that we might lose a job, or that
we might lose,
and we might lose a relationship. Or so we do worry about those things, and defiance is never risk-free. But there's also costs of compliance that sometimes we don't take into consideration. So if we are constantly disregarding our values, then that takes a toll on us. You know, we're not living. If we can't be our authentic selves, if we can't express ourselves in the workplace, there's research showing that we actually feel greater dissatisfaction, we feel greater burnout, and it takes its toll in terms of increased stress and other ailments. So it affects us psychologically, spiritually, and even physically if we can not express our true values. So what we need to do is really assess for those situations and think about those situations. And as I said, like if we look for, is it safe and will it be effective? And again, going back to the example and the clip that you played of Bishop Buddha, you know, was it safe and effective for her to defy? We all have some level of influence, sure, that we can sort of quietly demonstrate our values, you know, and it doesn't need to be a grand gesture. It could be standing up for a neighbor or supporting organizations that fight for justice or refusing to participate in systems that perpetuate harm. So there's things that we can do, but we should make an assessment of the costs.
We've touched on this, but you have a name for it. It's called insinuation anxiety, that it is to act against our values or in order to protect another person's feelings. And I think we can all relate to that in one way or another. Is you just, you know, you don't want to make someone uncomfortable or angry or sad or whatever that opinion is. Again, what inhibits us? And maybe it's the relationship that we have with the other person, or maybe it's, you know, I just don't want to go out on a limb at this time.
Right, right. So insinuation anxiety is a distinct type of anxiety that comes up. It arises in people when they worry that their non-compliance with another person's wishes is going to be interpreted as a signal of distrust. So it insinuates that the person is not whom they appear to be or should be. And probably when I describe it a little bit more, we probably can relate to situations where we've experienced insinuation anxiety. So it could be in very small stakes situations where, for example, for me, if I'm sat in the hairdresser's chair and they tell me, okay, this is what I'm going to do, you know, you've asked for this cut, and they start doing a little bit more, oh, you're going to love this, you're going to love this, and you're thinking, no, I'm not. It's very hard to tell them that that's not what you wanted, that's not what you asked for, and you probably sort of leave and tip them. But it also can happen in far more serious situations. So, for example, one survey found that only 9 in 10 healthcare workers, many of them nurses, felt comfortable speaking up when they saw their colleague or a physician making a mistake.
Only 1 in 10. Not 9 in 10, but only 1 in 10, right?
Well, sorry, 9 in 10 felt uncomfortable. So one in 10 felt, well, okay to do so.
To speak up, right.
So, yeah, so that's a huge amount. And it's not just in healthcare, in other industries. Another survey of 1,700 crew members in commercial airlines, about half of them felt uncomfortable to speak up. So this insinuation anxiety can account for why people don't speak up. It's very hard if your boss asks you to do something to insinuate they don't know what they're doing, if you think it's wrong. It's very hard for co-pilots to speak up to their pilots at times to tell them that they're doing something wrong. And it's very hard for nurses to tell physicians that, oh, hold on a minute, that's not the right way to go. And so that insinuation anxiety, yes, we worry about insinuating that the other person is untrustworthy, incompetent, corrupt, biased. And that's what keeps us silent. And I found this in a number of experiments. It's an aversive emotional state, and it happens even in one-off situations with strangers.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about that power differential, the co-pilot to the pilot, the nurse to the doctor, that there is that power dynamic that can inhibit people, which is, and how would I know? He's the doctor or she's the doctor.
Exactly. Yeah, there is that aspect of the power dynamic. But even if you have the knowledge and the understanding of the knowledge, going back to two of the five elements for consent, even if you have those things, the insinuation anxiety can still trip you up and make it difficult for you to defy.
You referenced this, but I thought this as a person who asks questions for a living, you say asking questions can be a form of defiance. That it's a way, I mean, it sort of diffuses the situation, but at the same time, it pushes back against what someone might be saying or doing.
Right. So I advocate for curiosity rather than confrontation. So when you're in that stage three of defiance and you're vocalizing to someone else, you can ask questions. Well, what exactly do you mean? Wouldn't that have this effect? Have you considered this other way? And what about doing this instead? You know, surely this might have it. So just asking those questions can really help clarify the situation. And it also raises the volume on the situation. Hmm. So once you start asking, other people might see and sort of think, okay, now I'm going to start asking too.
I mean, it reduces our natural defensiveness when someone is challenging our actions or our opinions.
Yeah, it's just suggesting you still can be in this subservient position at that point. You're not threatening to not comply with them. You're asking questions.
Which raises a question about workplaces. I mean, how can we create workplaces where defiance, your definition of defiance, is acceptable and even encouraged? Because I think, you know, most of us feel like we need to largely, not always, but largely obey, you know, the rules of the road when it comes to work. How do we make defiance of value in the workplace?
It's a great question. So defiance, the way I define defiance, will have a positive effect in the workplace, because if everybody is complying with their boss, then it's almost the death of creativity and innovation. It's if you cannot raise questions, if you cannot sort of show some defiance, if it's really just compliant and going along with everybody else, then innovation, I think, will go down. And also, as I said, if you're being compliant and bowing your head to people every day, we know that takes a toll on people and it increases stress level, dissatisfaction, loss of productivity. So all the things that workplaces are looking for. So the environment really matters. Like how is your boss going to react if you ask a question? Is it going to be explosive, or are they going to encourage that? And that makes a difference to the workplace. It's really the leaders. Can we make a psychologically safe environment where people can speak up without fear of repercussions?
Which is a tall order to get a workplace, you know, run by the bosses, to change the psychological environment there so people feel empowered to challenge their opinion. I mean, that's just almost like turning things upside down.
Well, is it a tall order? So for some managers, some workplaces, changing culture is a tall order. But within your own unit, for example, if you have empathy for your employees, if you have empathy for your direct reports, then not penalizing them for speaking up is the first aspect. The second is when they speak up is to listen, because the two main reasons people stop speaking up is fear of consequences and that, yes, I speak up, but nothing ever changes. So if you can implement those things as a leader, you actually see more positive benefits in the workplace.
You have something called ethical fading. If the goal is to please a boss or even maybe a political leader, then our ethical beliefs can kind of take a back seat, that we sort of lost connection to ourselves because I guess the goal is to please that person versus be our authentic self.
Yes, absolutely. So if we go back to sort of having to break that sort of equation that I grew up with, compliance equals good and defiance equals bad. If we see ourselves as being a good employee, is that just about pleasing the boss or making sure that we do the right thing? Because if our only moral assessment is how well we've obeyed the authority, then it could mean that ethical issues fade to the background and we don't really think about what does our job mean? What is it that we're doing? What if we don't stop to ask ourselves a simple question of whether what you are doing is ethical or not, you know? And there've been so many workplace scandals, right? So many ethical Yes. scandals. And if we could just ask ourselves that question, this is not just about pleasing the boss, but it's about the bigger picture, then that would help us make the decision that, again, is in alignment with who we aspire to be.
Should we bring defiance into the home, into the family? How does that work?
Again, I see defiance as a positive thing. So absolutely, like we don't want to be in a relationship where we cannot express who we are and what our values are. And then we need to sort of reframe, like when we talk about defiant children, it's always seen as this negative connotation, which is they're oppositional or they're doing something that it's not in alignment with what we want them to do. So for example, my son,
You talk about your son. Yeah, you do.
Yes. Like he has this phrase that I know very well now. And like, for example, when he's playing on like the computer, he's playing a game or he's on his Xbox. And I sort of wonder, okay, it's getting late now. Are you going to do your homework before tomorrow or not? And then we'll ask him, oh, are you going to go and do your homework now? And he's like, well, I was going to do it, but now that you've told me, I'm not going to do it. And what does
Been
that
there,
show?
Done that. Yes. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
What is that really showing? It's showing that his behavior is dependent on what I want, and he's listening intently to me. And he might not be complying. He might be doing the exact opposite. But both of those things require you to listen to somebody else and understand what they want and react to that rather than really thinking about what you want. And so that's false defiance. I don't see that as defiance, which is if the definition is to act in accordance with your true values when there's mm-hmm. pressure to do otherwise, defiance is actually a proactive, positive force in society, in relationships, in our workplaces.
But picking up on you and your teenage son and video games. What's the better scenario using that as an example?
For parents?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We there's a number of things we can do as parents, which is teach our children to be defiant so they really understand defiance. I mean, my son has now heard me say this story to other people and he gets it now. So like there was one time he was about to say, oh, if you want me to, and he was like, oh yeah, okay. You know, so it's kind of teaching them about sort of what is defiance, what is false defiance, and are you really acting in the way that's best for you? You know, don't let anybody else's opinion matter. Nobody's going to care more about your schoolwork and how well you do than you. Right. If you care about it, then that's should come from within. Right. That teachers, parents, we can't force our children to behave in a way that doesn't align with what they really want, because at some point they're going to leave the home and they're going to have to figure things out for who they are and what do they really want and what do they stand for.
And that's always a challenge with children growing up, because who they are is evolving over time. You know, who they were as a 6-year-old is probably different from when they're a 16-year-old.
I think so. And like, you know, as teenagers, we often try on different behaviors to see whether it fits. And that's the time for exploration. And that's fine. You know, let's just be careful how we define the behavior and not view defiance as a negative, negative trait.
So a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye. So are you a good defier? have you practiced what you preach?
I am certainly practicing every day, because one of the most important aspects of becoming what I call a moral maverick is like sort of learning the ability to speak up and act when it matters most, is to put that practice in every single day, because we can't just expect ourselves to be defiant in the moment of crisis. We need a step-by-step strategy to learn how to do it. And there's a wonderful quote that's often attributed to Bruce Lee because it's about training, but it was actually a Greek poet that said, under duress, we don't rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training. And so that aspect is really important. And we really do have to have a mindset shift in thinking of people as defiant people and obedient people, but just thinking of it as an act. Sometimes I can be defiant, sometimes I can be compliant, but how do I get more in alignment with my aspirational self?
Well, a perfect place to leave our conversation. Sunita Sah, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Nice to have you with us as well. And again, she is a physician-trained organizational psychologist at Cornell University. And we've been talking about a book that she has just written. It's titled Defy, and it's subtitled The Power of No in a World That Demands Yes. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection, the show produced by Debbie Bilder with Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.